Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our conversation both hours today focusing on elections, although these are fairly far away, but they may have ramifications for the United States. A lot of news about what happened in France, where the socialist candidate François Hollande won that election, and we'll be looking at the austerity project in the Eurozone, and he thinks that it's not going in the right direction. How important is France a player in all of that? And then in Greece, I mean, this news is really amazing. Quoting from the New York Times on Tuesday, which was yesterday, right? Greece teetered on the verge of political chaos on Monday with few signs that any party could form a governing coalition and the prospect of the nation leaving the Eurozone looming increasingly large. Very interesting results in that election. We'll hear about both of them and also talk about the austerity program in Europe, the European Union, the leadership of Germany, the strongest economy, what's going on in England. Our guest is Daphne Halikiopoulou, and she is a fellow in comparative politics in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. She lives in London, but she currently is in Athens, where she has been covering the Greek elections. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know it's a small world in many ways. Many of you may have relatives who are living in Europe, and you're hearing from them about what's going on, because it really is big political news in that part of the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Daphne, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, hello, and thank you very much for inviting me today.
Yes, a great pleasure. Well, how are things in Greece right now? Yesterday's newspaper said that it really is political chaos. Have things settled down a little bit in Greece today, or is it still political chaos?
It is still political chaos, I'm afraid, and negotiations keep going on, so things keep changing every minute. But as things stand at the moment, we're still unable to form a government. So what's happened since yesterday is the second largest party called Syriza, the coalition of the radical left. They're now trying to form a coalition government, as a strong majority government is impossible, but they want to form a coalition of the left, a government that will be consisting mainly of left-wing parties, and as they don't form the majority necessary, it looks highly unlikely. It looks like we'll be going to another round of elections.
Oh my goodness. And when you talk about a party of the left, what are the policies that people are advocating that would mean that they're a party of the left? How would they deal, for instance, on the austerity measures?
Okay, absolutely. I think I'll just go back a little bit and give you an idea of what these parties are, what their
Great.
Background is.
So, yes.
I think what is important to realize that this election in Greece was determined by the anti and pro bailout camps.
Mm.
So we have, the bailout, which is essentially the EU money, the sort of big bailout. The EU gave us money in return for certain austerity measures that the Greek government signed. So ever since, what's been going on is a sort of a cleavage in Greek society between the pro memorandum of understanding, the pro-bailout forces, which consist of the two main parties in the past, PASOK and New Democracy, so the centre-left and the centre-right, which have been the parties that have dominated the Greek political scene since 1974. So Greek society used to be a two-party system politically, two main parties together constituting about 80, 85 even percent of the seats in parliament.
Mm-hmm.
This has now broken down completely, as the majority of the people voted for the anti-bailout or the anti-memorandum of understanding camp that consists of parties ranging from the radical right to the radical left. The second party, which is, it's groundbreaking that a former small party could come second with 16.6% of the vote, is a party that stands firmly against the memorandum of understanding or the bailout, They say that they still want to stay in the Eurozone. They say they still want to keep Greece into the EU, but they want to cancel the terms and conditions of the memorandum completely. How they are going to negotiate this within the context of the Eurozone is unknown. We don't know. We do know that the leader of this party, Alexis Tsipras, only a couple of hours ago, I believe, sent a letter to the European Union saying that the terms and conditions of the bailout are no longer functioning in Greece.
The American News has made mention fairly frequently of this party, the Golden Dawn, whose members perform Nazi salutes, and they won enough votes to enter Parliament with 21 seats. Why did that happen? Is that a big story and a disturbing story in Greece?
I think it is. I think it is very disturbing, and I'm hoping it's only the immediate product of a crisis that will sort of calm down, because it is very disturbing. The Golden Dawn has been around for a long time, so it's nothing new. It's a sort of a violent street movement. I'll explain to you a bit more what they stand for. But it's a violent street movement that has been marginalized in past elections. And this time they gained, for them, what is a massive, I think almost 7% of the vote. And as you say, that translated into 21 parliamentary seats out of 300. That is extremely worrying, in that the Golden Dawn is a violent Nazi group, which is with a military organization. Mm. I've been doing a lot of a bit of research on its members, and these people appear, they are firmly anti-immigration. They endorse Nazism with whatever that may entail. So, you know, ultimate respect for the leader, strong disciplinary way of organizing the movement and organizing the people, violence in every way. This party advocates violence. What's interesting is that a lot of the members of this party who are now MPs have been convicted, have they've got criminal convictions.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, absolutely, for grievous bodily harm, theft, stabbing, etc. And what is particularly scary is that, as you probably know, in Greece, becoming an MP elevates you to the status of parliamentary immunity. So these people are now exempt from part of the law.
Mm.
People with criminal convictions, criminal records, are now partially exempt from the law.
Let's move to France here, where the victory of François Hollande has been much discussed in the American press as well. We're interpreting this as an acknowledgement on the part of voters in France and in Greece as well that the austerity measures aren't working very well. Is that why François Hollande won in France?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination. First thing I'd say is it's the Greek and the French case are interestingly linked, and the consequences of this sort of election that happened at the same time will be important as well. But why did Hollande win? Well, two features of the French elections I think are fundamental. One is the significant rise again of the radical right, which we can talk about a bit later if you like. And the second is this shift towards socialism. That took Nicolas Sarkozy out of power and made Hollande the president. The whole issue about austerity is essentially that in Europe, the welfare state doesn't have enough money, and that is a problem. That is basically what it boils down to. So the people who are paying for austerity are the public sector workers who are having their salaries cut, are the pensioners who are having their pensions cut, and are is the public sector in general, which can't function with any more cuts. That's essentially the idea. And a socialist government is one that is, or a socialist president like Hollande is one who came in and said, we need growth.
Mm-hmm.
His slogan for the whole election was not austerity, but growth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that depends on how one interprets growth, because
right,
a centre-right, you know, a centre-right government could also see growth as small public sector, more money for businesses, smaller taxes. But I think the way that François Hollande and the socialists are interpreting this growth is less, is allow the public sector to spend more. Don't shrink the public sector. Tax the rich more.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rich have more money to give. Use progressive taxes, so the higher your income, the more money you pay into taxation, and allow the public sector to function, because that is where investment should come from, the public sector. So don't cut pensions, don't cut health, don't cut, you know, education, pensions, all that. Increase the public sector, because that is where, that is where it should all come from. And interestingly, the Syriza, the Greek party, is of a similar, perhaps more radical view, which is something that is scaring the markets as well.
How large is the public sector, both in Greece and in France?
Big.
Very big.
The public sector is big. I mean, yes, it is. It's quite big, because there's a big welfare state that provides free health, free education, pensions for people. And it's quite big, but the more left-wing, clearly, the government, then the more they would wish to nationalize more and more services. So something that, for example, has, I think, worried people a little bit is, again, we're back to Greece, Syriza's proclamation yesterday that if they become government, what they will do is nationalize all the banks and then perhaps take some of the, the money, people's money, or the richest people's money, for public sector investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that created a bit of instability, clearly, because people were then worried about their the money in the bank.
Daphne, tell me more about this austerity pact that was signed with Germany and other European Union members. Angela Merkel is saying that she is not, that the austerity pact that really she put together it is not negotiable. Give me a history of how that got developed, who it affects, and if indeed these elections would indicate that maybe it is negotiable, the austerity pact.
Sure. Okay. So the big players in this are France and Germany, clearly, as strongest economies, perhaps, in the Eurozone, because, you know, the UK is not in the Eurozone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a plan that came out of the negotiation or the talks between Merkel and Sarkozy, France's president. What it really was, I mean, it affects all countries, but mostly the countries that are dealing with a crisis at the moment. These include Ireland, Italy, Portugal, Spain, but foremost Greece, because Greece has been the one that received, you know, the massive bailouts and is perhaps dealing with the biggest crisis of them all. Now, what the austerity plan is, it's, to make it very simple, they give Greece or other countries that have problems money, and in return, the governments of these countries, so the Greek government, for example, had to sign a particular memorandum of understanding that says that they will meet certain criteria. Now, these criteria are in accordance to the center-right ideology that I spoke about a bit earlier, which included cuts in the public sector,
mm-hmm.
right? So it included the shrinking of public services and, of course, lowering pensions, lowering public sector employees' wages, etc. Now, this affects Greece very much, and it's very important for Greece because it's another issue that is linked to this is corruption. So, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, there were many people that got their pension much earlier than they were entitled to in a nepotistic, corrupt way.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of people who, got into public, there were more public sector jobs than necessary, let's put it that way. And so now they're advocating austerity, that means cuts. But, of course, that creates huge trouble in society, in Greek society, because there's a lot of people who didn't get their pension in a corrupt way who have been paying.
Right.
And now
right.
find themselves getting 300 euros a month or mm-hmm. 500 euros a month, which is impossible to live with. There's a lot of public sector employees that are now being told that their jobs will be cut. What they also did is in Greece, I don't know if you know this, we used to have 14 salaries a year. So they said, you know, the Eurozone said, well, this is impossible. Every country has 12 salaries a year. Why are you having 14? Austerity, we need to cut these to 12. But of course, what they didn't foresee is that pensioners paid their tax 14 times a year to receive their pension, and now their pension is lowered. So this is they perceive this as unfair. What they didn't foresee is that the salaries maybe were 14 times a year, but they were far lower than the European counterparts. So all this austerity has created huge anger, basically. But to go back to your negotiation question, I think this remains to be seen because there is no precedence.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is some of the fiscal plans that were designed by Germany and France, then they were voted in, or some of them were voted in by EU members. I think notably the Czech Republic and the UK didn't agree to the last one. Some of these now need to be ratified by their national parliaments. For some, like the Republic of Ireland, they need to go to referendum. But the point is there is no precedent. We don't know really to what extent these are negotiable, because something like that has never happened again, as there is no precedent in what happens if a country leaves the European Union.
Hmm.
What happens if a country leaves the Eurozone? This is not planned for. You know, practically, the logistics of this would be impossible. What do? We issue drachma tomorrow? Can we leave the Eurozone but remain in the European Union? There's no provision for any of this. So I think in theory, things may sound a bit more dire than they are, you know. I mean, this is worrying, but at the same time, it's a massive headache for the European Union to lose Greece and to not negotiate at all. So, you know, I do think that a solution is possible, although we don't know how exactly this is going to happen.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them in just a moment. Our guest this hour is a fellow in comparative politics in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Daphne Halikiopoulou is with us, and she is in Athens right now. She's been covering the Greek elections, which took place over the weekend, and everything is still up in the air in Greece. Nobody can form a government. We're looking at what happened in France. We're looking at the German reaction to what's going on in France and in Greece, at the European Union, at austerity measures, at public workers, public sector, at socialism. You name it, the list is long. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Considering the fact that the world is very much interconnected, I'm sure that many of you know people or have family members who are working in Europe or living in Europe, and they are giving you their thoughts on what's going on politically in all of the countries that we've been talking about. So we'd like to hear from you as well. And did I tell you how you do that? Well, that's easy. You go to WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page too, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Madeleine Albright will be with us, former Secretary of State. She has written, I can't believe I remembered to bring the book in. She's written a book that looks at her life, and a fascinating one it is, in Prague. The name of the book is Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. So she will join us tomorrow. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, guest. I just wanted to point out that we're going to be hearing an awful lot about, in America, about socialist France and France going socialist. And my observation is, I taught briefly in Europe, and I do want to emphasize briefly, but I taught in one of the Nordic countries. And Germany is currently advocating austerity, and the Germans did bite the bullet in their own period of austerity when they were, I think it's called the shift from the Bond to the Berlin government, when after 1989 they eventually reunited Eastern Germany with what we called Western Germany. But they did so during a period of time when the rest of Europe was booming and was carrying them along as they suffered through austere conditions. The most successful countries in Europe, both in terms of economics and freedom, are the Nordic countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden. Iceland is coming back gangbusters because it nationalized its banks and took some what Americans would consider highly socialistic methods in dealing with the financial sector. And all I want to emphasize is that in America, we talk about socialism as though it's some sort of evil force in the world, whereas the whole European Union, by definition, is a socialist enterprise. That is, whenever societies join together to try to figure out what to do and to care for their citizens, as Germany does marvelously. Germany is a highly socialized nation in terms of health care and education and other things. And I just wanted to make that observation. Greece did not get into trouble because it was the most highly socialized country in Europe. And I think your guest made that point, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Daphne.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. It's very interesting. I would agree that the socialism in Europe has brought many good things. For example, things that we now consider to be a basic right, like the welfare state, as I said. So in Europe, free health is considered to be very basic. It's accepted everywhere. This is how it is. You know, equally the pension system, free education. And I think that's worked absolutely. It's worked well, and it's very true. And I think your caller is absolutely right in saying that the problem in Greece was not the socialist system per se. That would have been a good thing. But it's the problem that in its transition to industrialization, Greece, in its transition to becoming a state, it took its very highly corrupt structure with it. So what happened was that this socialism, this prominence of the state, this prominence of the public sector, came with a massive network of clientelistic relationships, to the extent that nobody could get any job unless, you know, there was nepotism involved, unless you knew someone who knew someone who knew someone. Mm-hmm. And this is how it was for getting, say, a state, you know, getting, if you were sick, to get a state, state money, you know, for a particular disease, or because you know, to get an early pension or anything. So unfortunately, a system that could be fair became a bottomless pit, really, where money was poured into and poured into and poured into, and this corrupt practices favored the few against others on the basis of nepotism and cronyism and clientelistic relationships. And I think that is the problem. Unless the Greek main parties that have mainstream, respectable ideologies that are around the center, unless these parties are able to completely detach themselves from the clientelism of the 90s and 80s and 2000s, that are deeply embedded in society, then I don't think there's a solution for Greece, whether we go for austerity or growth, to be honest.
It's so hard to be fair and just, isn't it? You think it'd be a lot simpler than it is, but it just isn't. But for a lot of governments.
It's difficult.
Yeah. Cody in Oshkosh. Yes. Hi, Cody.
I completely agree with the last caller and your guest. They kind of stole some of my thunder, but I was wondering, has Greece done things to get rid of this corruption? And could this actually be an economic model like the Nordic countries that other countries could use, for instance, the early retirement, the short work weeks and whatnot, which could increase employment for younger people? Thank you.
Thank you, Cody.
Okay. So the first question was, has Greece done anything to get rid of this corruption? My honest answer would be, I think very little. And I think the reason for that is, as I said, because really what these main parties have been dealing with was a catch-22 situation. So being able to really sort the economic problem out, they needed to get rid of corruption. But if they get rid of corruption, then nobody will vote for them, because the entire system, their entire electoral base, is those people who have been benefit from the two main parties. So in other words, they have done very little. It is very interesting that only just before the electoral campaign began, so maybe like a month ago, a former Greek minister, somebody called Akis Tohadopoulos, who was, I think, Minister for Foreign Affairs, who has been associated with numbers of scandals, was indicted and has been taken into prison while he's been investigated. But a lot of people pointed out that these are isolated cases that took place literally during the electoral campaign. And again, the question is, you know, what about more broadly? Would this person be one isolated phenomenon, the scapegoat, you know, to show, yes, we're doing something? This needs to be widespread, and I would say that it's yet to be done. If the tax evasion is tackled, then austerity wouldn't be that severe. Then you don't have to need to cut money off pensioners or to make the pension 700 euro from 800 euro, where you could really tackle tax evasion. And this has not been done. I'm afraid to say this has not been done. And to the question about could the Nordic countries be examples, I think that's very difficult, because two things you need to consider for that is, the one is they have small populations. These are countries of 4 million, 7 million people. And perhaps these models are easier when the countries are small. And secondly, they have a political culture. They developed that system. You know, again, in years and years and years of sort of slow transition to this system, it wasn't something that came onto them rapidly. I think that a country that has a long history of corruption like Greece would have a problem developing that. I mean, a Nordic country system with Greek corruption would be a disaster.
Thank you very much for the call, Cody. Could we spend just a few more moments talking about this focus on austerity versus focus on growth, and answer in terms of what the new president of France had to say about this, answer in terms of how Germany has dealt with this issue, because Germany has been touted as being the country that really has the strong, strong economic growth. What is it that will allow countries to grow, and why is it that Germany seems to be really doing very, very well here? Do they have more of a focus on austerity? What have they done to grow? How do you reconcile both of those, growth and austerity?
Okay, again, I mean, I think, as I said, the main point is how, it's interesting that they use growth, both use growth, and they use it in a completely different way. So I think it's interesting to see that growth, it fits in both models, and it depends on what kind of growth, how you want to achieve growth, what your vision of growth is. Now, François Hollande, I've got here a bit of a list of things that he suggested. As I said, I think the key thing to understand is his emphasis on taxation, the public sector, and growth as public sector investment. So I'll give you some ideas of what he has suggested. For example, he suggested to introduce two new higher tax rates. A scaled tax, and the more income you have, the more tax you will pay. So, for example, he suggested a 75% tax rate for those with incomes above 1 million euro. Right, so if you're very rich, you pay massive 75%. He also wanted to introduce a new 45% tax band for people who make more than 450,000 euro. Regarding what's interesting is about the European Union. So what François Hollande suggests is something that Nicolas Sarkozy dropped, which is the introduction of Eurobonds. So this was something that Sarkozy also had suggested, but because Merkel didn't want it, Germany doesn't want it, he dropped it, whereas François Hollande wants to bring that back on the table. So the creation of Eurobonds, essentially they would be issued by the European Central Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this would be, it would essentially be money that then they could use in different states as investment money, and if something was to go wrong, it's the European Central Bank that will be the guarantor. Which is an interesting thing. Now, Merkel doesn't seem to be very positive about this, so we'll see how negotiations pan out. So he generally wanted the European Central Bank to be more involved in everything. I don't know if this gives you an idea.
Yes.
What. And again, this is austerity. They also differ on issues such as immigration, but this is not necessarily linked to...
Well, let's contrast this with Germany, which seems to be doing just fine, thank you. What's the tax rate situation in Germany?
Germany has a more center-right policy, as I said. So they're more in favor of what we call austerity. Is basically what they want is... They want... the private sector to grow more. They think that basically public sector money, too much public sector money is a bit of a waste. So they would go for lower taxation, and they would go for less. They would basically go for, you know, less money into the public sector. But what is interesting to see is that, yeah, perhaps, I mean, perhaps Germany is doing so well, but they're not dealing with these, you know, these corruption, for example, problems that they have in Greece. So it's a wholly, I think it's a completely different system that they try to sort of export in different areas. And perhaps that is the problem. It's that a system may work well in one place, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it will work well in another that has a completely different political culture and a completely different way of functioning. But what is interesting to see is that also the government in Germany is becoming more and more unstable. They seem to be losing their support as well. So I don't know how, you know, what is happening in the rest of Europe will also affect the popularity of say, Angela Merkel and the center-right, A, because there's a trend towards the center-left and the radical right, which is dangerous, but also B, because they, you know, they are accountable to their electorate. The more money they have to pay into countries like Greece, the more their own electorate becomes dissatisfied with them. So it's a complex political game where economics and politics, you know, become linked.
Carl in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Kathleen. Your producers did an excellent job in getting this guest. Daphne, I get a lot of my information from The Guardian and when I have insomnia, the BBC at night, and from a lot of British sources that I'm sure you're very familiar with. I have three sort of intertwined questions, and I'll give them out real brief. To what extent is the whole crisis exacerbated by the fact that there's not a strong central bank like our Federal Reserve, for instance, independent? And for instance, you mentioned the euro bonds. If there were a strong independent central bank, they could issue those bonds if that was the tack they wanted to make. Another thing I've heard is that Goldman Sachs, at the point when Greece was adopting the euro, cooked the books, and everybody knew they did it, but no central bank stepped in and says, you can't do that. And the third thing is to what extent were the interest rates jumped on or increased in resolving the Greek crisis? In other words, they were forgiven substantial portions of their debt, but suppose, from what I understand, the interest rates that resulted were much higher than what they originally borrowed the money at. So maybe you could just comment on that if you can make any sense out of it. But I'm really interested in the central bank question about their independence.
All right. Thanks, Carl. Daphne.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much. These are extremely interesting questions. And I think the first question, yes, I think the fact that there is no central bank is a problem. And that is why what they're trying to do, that is why I think Hollande and a lot of people are emphasizing that now the European Central Bank should play in a way that kind of a role. So, you know, the individual state banks will not, you know, will be sort of, if there is trouble, the European Central Bank will be there to help out, to say it plainly. But there is a problem, I think we need to distinguish between the United States, which is essentially, you know, one nation state. So it has a European Central, it has a central bank. And the European Union, which isn't one state, and creating a one central bank among really what is 27 different nation states is a problem and something that not many want. So on the one hand, it could be a viable economic solution, but on the other, it creates many other problems of, you know, what is the European Union? How far does unification of the European Union need to go? And of course, who pays when something goes wrong? So the Eurobonds sound good, but then I suppose Germany would say, well, if we are the main guarantors in the European Central Bank, who is then responsible? Is it Germany that has to bail out and pay out whenever there's a problem? Secondly, about the cooking of the books, yes, that is true. And unfortunately in Greece, it's a very big, big thing because they said, well, Greece wasn't ready. Greece wasn't ready to join the Euro, and a lot of the problems stem from the fact that they just gave the wrong they gave fake information. They joined the euro with an economy that completely couldn't deal with it. And I'm afraid I think that's very true. And the last point about the interest rates, I think that's another excellent point. I completely agree with you. You see, what happened was that, yes, they've cut a lot of the loan money, but the interest rates are enormous. And this happened because the spreads basically collapsed. And this was the case when, I think, after 2009, when the Paso government got reelected, and then all of a sudden it started to become big that Greece is now increasingly failing a crisis. The markets weren't ready to deal with that. So what happened is the spreads just completely collapsed, and the interest rates rose up to the ceiling. And unfortunately, Greece at the moment, this is what the whole bailout is about. It's about paying one installment. We don't even have money, to just put it simply, we don't have money to pay the interest each month.
Give us an assessment, if you would, please, because it seems as though, even though there is a commitment to basic social services, a strong public sector among all of these countries, it seems to me in hearing you talk that the European Union may be a bit of a misnomer right now, because if anything, we've got very different kinds of election results taking place, different political philosophies, probably some resentment on the part of those stronger countries that they've had to bail out those countries that haven't been doing very well. Is it a hard thing to have a European Union, and is it becoming more and more difficult, do you think, Daphne?
Well, I mean, again, I think I would distinguish between the political, the economic, perhaps the ideological dimension of the EU. So, you know, these countries, I mean, one of the big Eurosceptic countries is, of course, the United Kingdom, that are all in favor of some loose monetary union, with perhaps some political union there, but completely oppose the idea of a very strong political union, you know, one EU constitution, one EU law that catches everybody, one EU currency. They're against the, you know, they didn't want to join the euro, and perhaps rightly. So I think if we're now talking about increased European integration, yes, it is problematic. It is problematic to merge 27 countries with different political cultures, different histories, different idea of how a nation state should be governed, mm-hmm. and different ideas of how the economy should be run into one whole. And this is what we're witnessing right now. But I think, again, the future of the European Union is very much dependent on what is going to happen in Greece and in France, and in maybe to a lesser extent also to these countries that are now also dealing with austerity and crisis, like Portugal, Italy, even Ireland. So I think, and this is, as I said before, this is something that is unprecedented. We don't have provisions for this. So I think it's, you know, it's the big players are going to play as they go along.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is joining us by phone from Athens, where she is currently examining the Greek elections and the lack of progress in that country, which continues today in trying to form some kind of government. Daphne Halikiokopoulou is our guest, a fellow in comparative politics in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Abu in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello, thank you. Just two points here, one about France, one about Greece. It was refreshing to see the French primaries 2 weeks ago, and especially listening to Marine Le Pen, who said things like, I hate bankers, and she was going to actually tax those companies which outsource. You know, by comparison, in America, we have prevarications and the freak show that we've been seeing for about 3-4 months. And the last time we heard some truth to power was like Marine Le Pen was with Ross Perot. And this all has to do with the outsourcing that has been occurring, the hollowing of the manufacturing sector. You know, now they're talking about these bonds and this and that and the other. It's merely financial engineering. But the core of the problem is the outsourcing. And the second thing on Greece is, you know, the way it's been characterized, even at the beginning of this show, as chaos, is somewhat hyperbolic. I mean, that's what you expect in a parliamentary system. It isn't as if people are going around and beating people up and firing and killing. This is just that there hasn't been an agreement on the agenda. But this is because of what I understand is a quirk in the Greek election system, meaning even though there were one or two points that separated the first two parties, the difference in the number of seats is enormous. It's more like the first party gets their share plus some more, and then the others get penalized, so to speak. So that, in fact, is the reason that they cannot form the kind of a majority coalition. Would you please comment on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Abu.
Thank you very much, Abu. I'll start by commenting on the second question first. I agree that, you know, speaking of chaos is perhaps too much. You know, we shouldn't exaggerate things, and I think, you know, keeping things calm is a good idea. We don't know what's going to happen. But I will disagree with you on the extent to which this particular election is quite unstable. It's been one of the most unstable elections since 1974, the restoration of democracy in Greece. I would say it's the most unstable election. Now, to comment on your point about the coalition, yes, it's a parliamentary system, and they're not agreeing. But the problem is that Greece hardly ever produces, the Greek system can't produce a strong majority government. It happened before in 1989, and that's the only time it's happened since the 1970s. So what we usually get is a strong majority government, a party which will get 40% of the vote, which then will translate, as you said, disproportionately into over 50 or 60 or 70% of the seats in parliament, and therefore they will be able to govern. So this election is particularly unstable because the strong majority government hasn't been formed, because it's groundbreaking that parties that used to gain 45% of the vote or 40% of the vote now got the New Democracy, which is the centre-right, they got 18.8, a record low. But most interestingly, PASOK, the party that has governed Greece from 1981 till 2004 again, and then again 2009 till last December, they got 13% of the vote. They got 41 seats in parliament. That is 120 seats less than they had in 2009. You can see why this is particularly, in any parliamentary system, why this is particularly an issue of instability. It's also an issue of instability because, again, we don't know whether the anti-bailout forces will gain, will become government. And if they do, it's going to be interesting to see how they will negotiate Greece's future in the European Union, but cancel the memorandum of understanding. So perhaps I would agree that chaos is an overstatement, but that there is some instability there that remains to be seen how it will be tackled. It's an important election, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Let's,
and to go to... Sorry, yeah.
No, go ahead.
And I just wanted to very briefly comment on the Marine Le Pen issue. Look, the far right is gaining prominence in the whole of the EU because of, you know, partly because of the reasons that you have said, but again, the far right is worrying because they are anti-EU and they are anti-immigration and they seek more isolationist policies, and that could be dangerous when you think that, for example, in France, 18% of the population voted for something on the side of the radicals. But I wouldn't put Marine Le Pen or other radical right parties in Europe in the same category as the Greek Golden Dawn, as I said earlier, because they are an extreme Nazi party. So they are beyond what we think is the radical right.
Here's an email that's come in along those lines. If we could talk about this and get a historical take, how far can we take the analogies of today to the interwar period when economic depression led to the rise of fascist governments in Germany and in Italy? Are we at a time where we need to be concerned about that, Daphne?
Right. So, I mean, I would start by saying that in Greece in particular, there is a resemblance with the 1930s. The resemblance is you have a massive economic crisis, and all of a sudden you witness fascism or Nazism even in parliament. And you also witness, what we are witnessing is the rise of parties with a traditional ideological basis. And this is unlike the rest of Europe, which is interesting. So take, for example, the Dutch Freedom Party, Geert Wilders' party, or take Marine Le Pen, or take the Swiss SVP. Take these parties. They are radical right, but they are revamped radical right parties. So they don't want to be anti-systemic, right? So they operate within the system of democracy, and they're revamping their ideology to say, well, we're targeting immigration, but really what we're targeting is people who are intolerant. So we are defined by a tolerance. We will target those who are intolerant of our tolerant ideas. Mm. So they become, it is understandable in a way why, whereas, you know, obviously we don't, you know, we wouldn't say they're illegitimate. What they're trying to do is become more legitimate within their electoral arenas by portraying themselves as intolerant of the intolerant. So that's why a lot of them are targeted against Muslim extremism, right? So they no longer have such a rhetoric that targets, say, Jewish people or, people of particular racial backgrounds. They target Muslim extremism in particular. Now, interestingly, in Greece, this is not the case. The Golden Dawn is a Nazi party that adheres to Nazi ideology. As I said, a militant party that, you know, has been associated with Nazism, that they endorse Hitler's ideas. They blatantly come out and, say how they feel about Jewish people and other racial people of other racial backgrounds. They are extremely anti-immigration, and they're also against the Greek traitors as well. I put that in quotation marks. So they resemble the 1930s far more, if you know what I mean, than
yes.
Other parties in Europe do. Yeah.
It's hard to imagine why anybody would vote for them, Daphne.
Now that's a very interesting thing that you're raising. Initially, people estimated that what was happening was that people who live, Athenians especially, but also people in the urban centers that lived in deprived areas with high levels of immigration, they would be the ones who would vote for the Golden Dawn. Elderly people who are afraid, to go to the bank alone or afraid to get out of their houses alone because they live in, quite crime-ridden areas. And all of a sudden, the Golden Dawn became a sort of an urban Robin Hood, if you like, so they would walk the elderly to the bank and provide protection and security for them. So initially it was estimated that it would be that would be the Golden Dawn's electoral base. But data that we're now getting from the polls are indicating that actually the Golden Dawn was highly successful across Greece. So
really?
There's no urban, urban-rural divide. In fact, in some rural areas like Corinth, they got 12% of the vote. In some other constituencies, they were maybe the first or the second party, like in Evia, I believe. And, polling data indicates that their main electoral base is male population between the ages of 18 and 50 or 55, with quite low educational backgrounds. Mm. So, but it's interesting that it is nationwide and very widespread. Yeah.
Let's go to Scott. We go to Scott in Columbus next. Hi, Scott.
Thank you. I think it's worth elaborating on the point that Carl made. Greece is the poorest country in the European Union. That was true when they joined. They were also allowed to carry more. They had more debt than the European Union Charter allowed at that time. They were granted a waiver, at least that's my understanding. So Germany and other, Netherlands and other member countries bear some responsibility for Greece coming in the condition they did. At that, around that time, Goldman Sachs made a deal with the Greek government to disguise their financial situation by infusing billions into the economy. For that Goldman executives pocketed $300 million. It was disguised in Greek taxpayer money. It was disguised as a currency trade, so it wouldn't show up on the balance sheet. As a result, Greece gave up 10 years of income from airport taxes and lottery, almost virtually ensuring that Greece would not be able to meet their debt obligations into the future. A good old U.S., financial corporation cooperated and aided and abetted the corruption in Greece.
We have a minute left, Daphne.
Okay, so I'll be very fast. All I have to say is, all I can say is it's a good point, and I absolutely agree. And a lot of the, but this is something that is fueling a lot more anger in Greece, because what has been said is, well, you know what, you cook the books, you let Greece into the Eurozone, and in addition to that, you why did you lend us money when you knew that we were the poorest country in the EU with high corruption levels and that we couldn't meet those requirements? But unfortunately, this is now fueling in the anger and fueling into the instability that we're witnessing.
Hmm. How long? 1 minute. Yeah, that you did it in less than a minute. That was quite an accomplishment. How long will you be in Greece? Are you going to wait until a government is formed?
No, unfortunately, I have to go back to work, so I will be leaving in a couple of days, but we'll see if there's going to be a... It's likely there will be a new election, and that will be in mid-June, so hopefully I will be able to come back and vote again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us, Daphne. I hope you'll join us again. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Our guest, a fellow in comparative politics in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. She is Daphne Halikiopoulou, and she was joining us by phone from Athens, where she's been covering the Greek elections. We thank her for her expertise covering the European Union and the various elections in the past couple weeks among various countries in the European Union. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, Madeleine Albright will be joining us. She's written a book about her years in Prague and her family, and that will be tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation. Clear, straight, open. From NPR News.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells. Vacation planning tools like the 2012 Wisconsin Dells Vacation Guide are now available. More at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.